Dr. David Minkoff.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
We bit that apple and the garden was lost. And so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But don't you know we're gonna have to burn
too many things. There's too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dora Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the words to that song, except for the one, Solartopia, which I wrote. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back to you with another hour in Solartopia here on PRN. We're going to talk today about election protection and all that great stuff. Barbara Arnwine, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right, the great Barbara. So glad to have you with us on the radio again. You are such a terrific host and activist, a guest and activist. I'm sure you're a great host, too. And tell people who you are. I have such great guests, you among them, that I don't like to describe them. So you tell us, Barbara, all about you.
Thank you so much, Wasserman, for having me on. I am the president of the Transformative Justice Coalition, which is a national racial, economic and environmental justice organization. And we work across the country on many issues of criticality, but one of our biggest issues, of course, is voting rights. And we are extremely involved. Before coming to and founding the Transformative Justice Coalition for 26 years, I was the executive director and president of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which is one of our nation's largest pro bono legal networks that fight for racial justice.
Good for you. I know you to be a very profoundly articulate and powerful activist with a great reputation. We're going to talk about elections today, and you are the perfect person to be joined by Steve Rosenfeld. Steve, are you here?
Yes. Hi. Hanging to both of you guys.
Steve Rosenfeld, author, activist, one of the nation's leading experts on election protection and election theft, and certainly stream of voting machines that's pouring into our electoral system that will play a big role in deciding the outcome in 2020, if in fact there's election, if Donald Trump somehow does not cancel them, I can't resist. I mean, I am not a fan of Nancy Pelosi. I think she's way too conservative for me. I think that the corporate Democrats that she personifies are responsible for Donald Trump being in the White House. We can go into that later or whenever, but we got a lot of detailed stuff to discuss, important technical stuff and others. But I got to say, I am very glad that she is sitting on this impeachment. I hope she sits on it through November, frankly. I mean, obviously, you don't walk into a casino where the game is rigged, and that's the U.S. Senate. And I think she ought to just play with Moscow Mitch's head for the next, 11 months. Barbara, what do you think of that?
Well, you know, I'm a big proponent of not sending it over to the Senate until there's some guarantee that you're going to have something approximating a trial, a fair trial, and not a rigged commercial. Because, I mean, what they intend to do, as you and I and all of us know, is to just create a big old commercial for Donald Trump to talk about how great he is and have witness, if there's any witness at all, of these people talking about how wonderful he's been and, just lauding him and just trying to build up his credentials and for the reelection. I mean, so this is just going to be nonsense. That's all they're telling us they're going to do. They're not trying to have any real effort to get at the truth, to hold him accountable to the degree required by law, and to make sure that our Constitution is upheld. They just have no interest in that.
I agree 100%. Steve, what do you think?
Well, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, is my congresswoman. For decades, she was basically invisible in our district. And in the past 2 years, she has really stepped up in ways that I never would have expected. I think she has brilliantly handled breaking the monopoly on the political narrative that the president has had pretty much since just before his inauguration. And it remains to be seen what will happen with the Senate. You know, I was woke up this morning wondering if she was going to possibly appoint herself as being one of the impeachment managers if Mitch McConnell was going to be basically, you know, saying no witnesses and trying to, you know, impede any kind of a, you know, deliberative process. But we shall see. It's certainly new territory.
Well, I think it's always a mistake in public relations terms to appoint yourself to anything. There was a classic case in Minnesota. They had a governor. His name was Wendell Anderson, and the Senate seat opened up. And, you know, he was very popular, and Minnesotans are also nice. And then he appointed himself to the Senate seat and completely ended his career. And people were outraged. It was not an unreasonable thing to do, but, you know, it just, I don't think, she doesn't need to appoint herself to anything. She's king of queen of the roost right now. But I guess we'll see.
In my area of really knowing, I'm just telling you as somebody who lives in the district and has watched all this.
Yeah. Well, like I say, I think she's way too conservative for me. She comes from a certain ilk of corporate Democrats that I find very hard to take. But I got to say that she's seeing the reality of what a farce it would be to turn this a particular impeachment over to the Senate. And it is very, very completely new ground. I mean, nobody ever did that before. When the House impeached Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, it went straight to the Senate, and it played out as it did. And I have to remind people of one thing, and this is when I was a kid, or a college student, I guess, I read John Kennedy's profiles in Courage. And one of the people who's, I guess I read it in early 1960s. I was in high school when Kennedy came in. And one of the guys who's profiled in Courage was a Republican senator from Nebraska named Ross. I think was his name. And he bucked the tide and voted against removing Andrew Johnson. And his vote was actually decisive. And Kennedy portrayed this as a great act of courage, but it actually had a terrible impact on American history. I think it would have been a great thing if in 1867, the Congress had actually removed Andrew Johnson. He needed to go. He was a terrible guy, and we needed to have precedent of the Congress actually removing a president. And, you know, in Bill Clinton's case, I think he should have resigned. I mean, it was outrageous what he did, and it was not impeachable in any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, he hamstrung the country for years when he was supposed to be delivering a progressive agenda, which he never did. And, you know, people are talking. I heard David Gergen talk, who I actually like, David Gergen. I respect David Gergen, you know, about how at least Nixon left. You know, there's a case to be made for that. So, but no one has ever delayed the delivery of the impeachment indictment. I mean, that's basically what impeachment is an indictment. But I think we now, and I hope she sticks with it, you know, because it's a great thing to do. And I think the bumper stickers should no longer say impeachment. They should say remove with an exclamation point. Right, Barbara, don't you think?
Absolutely. And you know, I'm glad that people are beginning to trend, you know, the whole, you know, remove Trump message. And I think the polling has been very interesting and substantial that people believe that he should be impeached and removed. And I just want to note, of course, I'm speaking from my personal viewpoints, you know, Transformative Justice Coalition can't, you know, is not involved in the impeachment process as an organization because we're a 501c3. But personally, you know, as a voting rights, you know, personally as a civil rights and racial justice, you know, great old, you know, social justice activist, you know, I believe very strongly that he should be impeached and removed, that he has violated our Constitution. And to say violated is really to be euphemistic, because he has embarrassed our nation internationally and has caused, you know, severe damage not only to the U.S. Reputation, but has harmed nations, harmed people. You know, you probably saw the, I don't know if people have seen the videos of folks in the Caribbean dancing last night and holding parties celebrating the impeachment because of the damage he's done to Puerto Rico, the damage he's done to the Bahamas, the damage he's done by calling their nations, with hateful words, the racism. I mean, people in other countries were holding parties last night in the streets celebrating the impeachment. That is not a reputation that you want the leader of your nation to have, and you don't want the kind of harm that we've seen from the Muslim, policies, the Muslim ban that we've seen from, you know, our horrible, you know, efforts in Syria, our terrible, you know, terrible consequences of this whole Putin-Russian alignment that he's created that is so undermining to democracy.
Well, I got to say, actually, impeachment is done. Impeachment is no longer an issue.
Right.
I mean, Ralph Nader has argued, I think, with great justice, that the indictment is too narrow and that they should have got him on some of the other stuff he's done, like money laundering and all that. But he is impeached. That's over. The question now is removal. I think most people in the country, they don't really understand the process. Impeachment really is just an indictment. And the House has served as a grand jury, and now it's the Senate who's the actual jury. And I hope Nancy Pelosi plays them all the way to the election. There's no reason to go to trial in there. It's a rigged game. You know, it's like a black person going in front of a jury and Alabama in 1872. You know, I mean, it's not worth the time. So we will see. It's fantastic that they have stepped up, and I just wish it had been a broad. I actually met Adam Schiff in Southern California. He represents the district next to me in L.A., and I begged him to deal with money laundering, and they didn't do it. I also asked him to start referring to Trump as Fredo. He claimed, you know, from The Godfather, he claimed not to know what I was talking about, but he's actually pretty hip. And if you hear for some reason Adam Schiff referring to Trump as Fredo, you can credit me for that one. So anyway, all right, but let's move now to the order of the day. You two are among the very, very most important leaders in dealing with our election protection. And I want to start with the most egregious thing that's going on with you, Barbara, with this, is the woman in Texas who has been indicted and sent to prison for voting. Do you want to talk about that case? I mean, that is just outrageous. I mean, absolutely outrageous.
Well, there are, you know, roughly anywhere from 22 to 31 states that once somebody is released from prison, if they had a felony conviction, they are barred from voting, meaning they are banned, cannot vote, while they're under what's called court supervision, parole, or probation. And please note, everyone, that for most people, you know, those are time limited. Sometimes they're, as you know, 7 years, sometimes they're 15 years. But there are states that actually have lifetime probation. So that means people are banned for life being able to vote. And there are a few states that actually ban you not only for felonies, but for what they call high misdemeanors also. So the problem is that you can have states that are next door to each other, and one state will have a requirement that you cannot, vote while you're under court supervision, parole, or probation, and the state next door will say that you can immediately vote. Once you walk out of prison, it's true in Maryland and true in many other states. There are no restrictions. The problem is that people don't know. They don't know if, in fact, they are eligible to vote because when they leave prison, they don't receive any information about their voting rights in most states. They don't, and the Board of Elections does not put on their websites or send people any accurate information as right to vote. So people are out there trying to figure it out. And they naturally, I'm out of jail. I'm working in my community, I'm paying taxes. I'm doing all these things. Of course I can vote. And so they will register. They will go to, and the voter registration officials are trained to ask people, by the way, are you sure that you're eligible? Are you not? Make sure that you're not on parole or under court supervision. They don't do that. They just tell people, oh, yes, of course you can vote. And in Crystal Mason's case, she actually asked the question of the first registrar that she met, could she vote? And the person said, of course you can vote. So that's the problem. There's no way for these people to know. So what that means is that for Crystal Mason, she registered to vote, and she voted. And then she was arrested, as has at least another, I mean, there's probably over 100 people who have been arrested, you know, nationwide on the allegations that they were formerly incarcerated and were illegally voting. And she is threatened, as we all know, with 5 years of jail time, again, for trying to be patriotic and voting. The tragedy of this is it's not just Crystal Mason, a woman who was doing everything in her power to get her life together, to be a model citizen. It's not just her. But the tragedy is that there are an estimated 13 to 17 million people sitting out there right now in states throughout the country who are actually eligible to vote, meaning they have every right in their state to sign up and to vote, even though they're formerly incarcerated, even though they had a felony record. Their states say that they are entitled to vote, but they won't register. They won't vote because they're confused. That's how bad it is. And the states won't take responsibility for reaching out to those voters, for reaching out and informing people of their voting rights. That is the nature of voter suppression in our country.
Right. And let me jump in here and then we'll talk to Steve. This is not accidental. I mean,
not at all.
The strategy after the Civil War was you put in the Confederate states, the 11 former states of the Confederacy, put in restrictions that if you're a felon, you can never vote again. And then they went around and arrested every black person they could find, and convicted them felonies, and they were deprived of their vote. And that was not accidental. That was part of the whole Jim Crow infrastructure. And then, as the civil rights movement succeeded in the 1960s, Nixon, struck back with the drug war. And we can see this in the great book, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, law professor from Ohio State, and she pointed out that the early 70s, when Nixon declared that in the middle of the Vietnam War with terrible poverty, environmental destruction, all that stuff, Nixon declares that the number one problem in America is drugs, and he includes marijuana, which, you know, I don't consider to be a drug. It's basically an herb. And they did a major study. They had a commission that was headed by a Republican governor, Schaefer, of Pennsylvania. This is all in my history book, by the way, People's Spiral of U.S. History. This commission came back and said, well, pot's not a big deal. People don't die from pot. It might make you stupid if you smoke it too early, but otherwise there's no reason to go after pot. And Nixon completely ignored it, and they declared the drug war. And since the early 70s, in pursuit of marijuana and other related substances, they arrested more than 40 million people. 40 million people. And, of course, the majority were black and Hispanic, and it was designed to break the civil rights movement and put people of color in prison and deprive them of the vote. And that's how the Republicans have been so powerful over the years and how moved the Democrats to the right. I mean, you took a whole generation of young people of color and also basically the hippie culture and put it in prison. That's what's happened. And this situation with Crystal Mason and the others, you know, it's basically to terrorize people of color and young people from voting. Steve, you follow this pretty closely. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, it's really discouraging that this stuff just keeps continuing. I mean, I remember writing stories for, 10 years ago out of Texas, when then Attorney General Greg Abbott would send in, you know, Texas Rangers to walk past crack houses and arrest, you know, elderly African American women in taking showers in their 60s, you know, for helping somebody at a nursing home fill out a voter registration form. I'm not making this stuff up, and it's just the way that it continues. You know, but the thing that's particularly notable about the numbers that Barbara just talked about there, I mean, you know, we are lucky if we get, you know, 140 million people voting in a presidential election, and that maybe, you know, gets a little bit above, like, maybe it approaches 55%. So we're talking, you know, people always scratch their heads and they say, well, where are all these people who don't vote? Why don't they vote? Well, I mean, you're talking about a 10% there, a figure that's on par with the impact of gerrymandering, which is segregating voters by party loyalty identity. You know, that's another 10%. Now, those margins are what's big enough, you know, to really change the political culture of states and, you know, and Congress. And I don't think I've heard anybody really talk about it in those terms. I know we have seen, you know, efforts to try to re-enfranchise felons former felons in certain states, and of course they're being met with different kinds of resistance. And we'll have to see what happens in Florida, where it's the most 1.5 or 1.6 million. Kentucky, I think, is the number two state, and we'll get to see what happens there. There's a new Democratic governor, but. You know, and you know, so what? But what we see here, if you want to point to a pattern, you know, particularly this stage in, you know, the election cycle, is really going after big swaths of the electorate. You know, trying to use these technicalities to try to basically remove people who are otherwise eligible from voter rolls, and won't know until it's too late to do too much about it, or if they can do anything, it'll delay other people from voting on election day. And unfortunately, you know, that's where we are on this stuff.
Yes, it's a clear strategy. Obviously, it's race-based, although it's very clear that Nixon's drug war targeted the counterculture, you know, the white hippie subculture as well. And there's a great quote that's circulated, and I put it in my book, from John Ehrlichman, essentially saying that, we did the drug war to bust these people who were organizing to put a generation in prison. And at the end of it, he says, and we knew that pot wasn't dangerous. And he says, basically, did we know we were lying? Of course we did. I mean, you know, so the whole drug war has been about preventing people from voting. And now they're doing exactly what they did in the Jim Crow South after the Civil War, which is preventing felons from voting and basically terrorizing a major chunk of the population to keep them from voting. Barbara Arnwine, how do we overcome this?
Well, first of all, let me just point out that we know that the GOP strategy has, you know, two prongs to it. One is to shrink the electorate, to shrink it down. They would like to eliminate between 5 and 20% of all existing registered voters, mainly targeting, you know, people of color, low-income community, and students. They have, you know, a real hatred of students who they consider too liberal. So that's their strategy. They want to get rid of about 20, you know, million people off the rolls or to keep them from voting. So part of their strategy is to use, voter restriction laws to make it very difficult for people to vote, to get rid of early voting, to eliminate same-day registration, to have, you know, hard voter ID laws, to get rid of souls to the polls Sundays where people can vote, trying to get rid of and make it hard for people to register to vote, making it difficult by purging the voter rolls, throwing millions of people off the voter rolls through voter purging. They're doing everything in their power to shrink the electorate. Their strategy only works, and this is the second prong, if, in fact, the voters are unaware. They count on voter ignorance to win, and that is that they count on the fact that voters won't know that they've been purged, that voters will not be aware that they don't have the right ID to vote. They count on voters not having the ability to know that they're in a state that says that if you're not at the correct precinct, doesn't matter if you're in the right county, doesn't matter if you're even in your same neighborhood, but if you're not at the right precinct in Ohio and in some other states, they will throw your vote out. Even if they allow you to vote, afterwards, when it comes time to counting, they discard your vote. So people don't know these things. They, they have no idea, and they count on that, existing voter ignorance. So how do you counter it? You counter it in many, many ways. One is by aggressive, very aggressive, persistent, wide-ranging, prevalent, pervasive voter education. There's nothing more important. Second, you do amazingly aggressive voter registration, because they can purge all they want to, but the reality is that people can re-register, and people can register. The third thing is that you have to have an aggressive registration process for new voters. 8 million people who weren't able to vote in 2016 can vote now. They've become eligible in those 2 years. There are 51 million unregistered, eligible Americans in this country who just aren't registered. Even if, we know 30% of them say that they don't, want to vote, but that leaves 70% who say that they can't figure it out, that it's too difficult to register, that it's too confusing, that they don't have the time, that it's just a headache for them to figure out this process. We got to help them. The other thing we have to do is fight like we're crazy, fight at every stage voter suppression. I'm so proud of the people in Georgia who are fighting right now that voter purge. I'm so proud of the people in Wisconsin who are fighting the voter purge there. We're talking about between those two states, 550,000 people who would be purged from the rolls, if those purges were allowed to persist. And I'm so proud of the people in New Jersey who just fought and got their state legislature to pass a new law that removes the bans on for people who are on parole or probation in that state. They now, 83,000 people now can vote. Proud of the people in Kentucky who elected a governor, a new governor who just restored the right to vote to 140,000 people. I mean, proud of, you know, all these efforts. We got to fight like we have never fought before, because I'm going to tell you one thing. The other side has declared war. And if we don't understand that it's not business as usual, that we are in a war when it comes to the vote, that we are in a war, that this is warfare, that if people don't understand that, that means we got to be able to mobilize our troops, able to fight and to win, then we lose. So it's critical that we recognize we're at war. We recognize that we got to fight like never before.
Wow. Well, very well stated. And I couldn't agree with you more. Steve Rosenfeld, you are studying in great detail these purges. I know you've been very close to it. Talk to us, if you can, about Florida, Wisconsin, and Georgia, and any other states that pop to mind about where the purge process is really very substantial.
Well, yeah, I don't want to get lost in the weeds here, and I haven't been studying it as much as I have in the past, but I did make some phone calls to find out what's really going on in Wisconsin, for example, and I really would be curious to hear what Barbara has to say about this, because, for example, Wisconsin is one of 25 states that now is part of this consortium that was created. It's called ericstates.org. And I know about ericstates.org because it was a project of the Pew Center on the States, and I was the person who was the staff writer on the original committee that created it. And what it does is it basically goes into every state and uses state data, and if states agree to be part of it, they identify all the eligible but unregistered voters and try to contact them. But at the same time, they try to use better data than what state election officials have generally used to figure out where people have moved and to clean up those rolls. So the thing about that is I'm trying to find out, well, if you're a member of this consortium like Wisconsin recently joined and Florida joined and I think Georgia is set to join and Ohio has joined, then where's the monkey business coming from that's basically, you know, generating these numbers that are hundreds of thousands at a time? So for example, so I called this fellow who works at it used to be called, it's called the Wisconsin Elections Commission. And I said, what is going on here? And I said, you know, tell me what's really behind these numbers and how many people you think, you know, are really going to be affected here. And he said, well, yeah, last year they sent out 1 million letters or postcards to people. Now, maybe that's part of the problem, that they're sending letters and postcards and it's not emails or something else, to people who were eligible but unregistered voters. He said of the 234,000 that were sent letters, now this is a conservative judge that said they have to take them all off the list, and it's a lawsuit from a right-wing organization that basically, following a bad Supreme Court decision that gives states more discretion and not good discretion to do disproportionate targeting, basically found an ambiguity, and I won't get into like the nooks and crannies, but they're trying to exploit an ambiguity in the law that says these 234,000 people who didn't respond to these letters have to be removed now. And they went judge shopping, and they found a right wing judge who said do it now. So what he said is that of that 234,000, that most of them are known to have moved. The problem is they don't know which ones have moved. He said they generally think it's about 10% are wrong. So that means that maybe 25,000 people will be incorrectly removed, you know, not 234,000. that's still a number that was bigger than the margin in the last presidential election, and it's by no means acceptable. You know, in Georgia, just an hour or so before today's show, somebody who I know was an expert witness testified yesterday in this lawsuit that was challenging that state purge there, and they found of 120,000 people who were supposedly getting ready to be struck from the rolls, that roughly 20%, you know, a little more than 20,000, were incorrect. So these are really big, really big error rates affecting tens of thousands of people at a time. And these are supposed to be with quote unquote new and better data systems, and I don't know what's breaking down here, and maybe Barbara does, but this is really cutting edge. It's happening right now, and Barbara, what have you heard? Because that's the most I have. You know, still 10% of Wisconsin is. You know, they know is wrong, and they're not sure what they're going to do about it.
Barbara?
Yes. You know, the reality is every time there's a voter purge, it's extremely flawed. I haven't seen one voter purge yet that has ever been clean and accurate. Every voter purge I've had to litigate against, to fight or to advocate against, has been flawed. Remember that the assumption under the NVRA and HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, the assumption is that you want to keep, you know, accurate mailing lists, with accurate addresses so that if people have died, that they're off the voter rolls. If people have moved to another state, that they're off the voter rolls. So the presumption in the law is that you want to have an accurate list, but the assumption also is that you don't want to deny anybody their right to stay registered who are legally residing where they are registered to reside. So one of the problems is that, under the Husted case that was heard by the Supreme Court 2 years ago, they said that that states can take people off polls if that person has not voted, as the law says that they can be taken off the rolls, if they haven't voted in the last two federal general elections. It also says that before states can do that, that they have to give people notice by sending some letter or some notification, a reliable notification to people, that they will, in fact, be taken off the rolls if they don't respond. The problem is that has created a whole industry for voter suppressors because they're able to take what they call a postcard and send this postcard out to people, and people get the postcard. Frankly, it looks like spam. Like all that junk mail we all get saying, oh, do you want to, rent? Do you want to sell your house? Whatever. You know, or do you want to, buy some shoes, fly to Mexico, wherever. All of this stuff that we get, that spam that we throw in the trash. And we know, and even the Supreme Court admitted that 60 to 80% of people who get these postcards put them in the trash. And they don't return them. So they know that this is going to create disenfranchisement, and they know that they're using a very unreliable basis to presume that people have moved, and they're not doing what could be much more accurate for systems. The other problem is ERIC. You know, ERIC itself, like you were saying, Steve, has a 7% error rate. That's high. That's not 1%, that's 7%. So if you're talking about 234,000 people, that means 30-something thousand of those people are going to be wrong immediately on that list. That's too many people to be sacrificing. So we know that this use it or lose it concept, I think that you ought to be able to register, and you don't have to vote if you don't want to vote. I think the idea that you got to use it or lose it is absolutely insane in a democracy. That people look around, they don't like the candidates, they shouldn't be compelled to vote. I would hope they would vote, but I don't think that there should be a use it or lose it concept. The other thing is this postcard voter suppression. It should not exist. It's a very bad system, and we can do better. We are a nation, you know, we are a world now with all kinds of capabilities to accurately know where people live. And to be able to find them at their correct address without doing the system. So I am 100% convinced that these purges are nothing but racially targeted fronts to shrink the electorate and to get rid of people who they don't know, who they don't want to vote. It's ironic. In Oklahoma, it's ironic that in Ohio, it's ironic that in Wisconsin, in Georgia, that the people who are on those lists to be purged are mainly people of color, low-income people, and low-income people, I should say, and that they are not targeting and sending these postcards to what they consider GOP districts. So it's not like they're flipping the whole state with these postcards. They're targeting who they send them to, which jurisdictions they send them to. So it's all racially biased. It's all designed to just suppress the vote. But like I said before, the good news is that if they purge you, you can just re-register. But you can't re-register if you don't know you've been purged. And so that's the irony, and that's the problem that we have that we must and that we will overcome.
We're talking with Barbara Arnwine here, a great voting rights activist, and Steve Rosenfeld, one of the prime journalists covering the rigging of and stripping and flipping of our elections. This is the issue. I mean, the outcome of the 2020 election is being decided now. In states like Wisconsin, Ohio,
yes.
Florida, Georgia, and Texas. And, you know, Texas is on the brink. Texas and Georgia both, which have been solid bastions of the conservative post-slavery structure, are flirting now with becoming swing states. And, this could be the last election, 2020, where Florida and Georgia go Republican. Florida is technically a swing state. I mean, Texas, it'd be quite amazing to see, Texas, of course, went for Lyndon Johnson in 1964. I think that's the last Democrat that state went for. So, the mechanics of this, the details, are really critical. And what's interesting to me, one of the many things interesting to me is that Wisconsin is in the middle of this, but Wisconsin now has a Democratic governor. Steve, you've been following Wisconsin pretty closely. What's the dynamic there? Has the new Democratic governor been able to? I assume they still have a Republican Secretary of State. So, what's going on there?
Well, the new Democratic governor has protested these numbers, and he's basically said, more or less what Barbara has said, that this error rate is completely unacceptable. I would like to learn more about where their error rate comes from, because the underlying data that is used to identify these supposedly questioned voters are they're just known to be error laden state and federal databases, a lot of them, and they don't use a lot of more recent stuff like credit card changes of addresses and things like that. It's just one of these things where if there was a will, there was a way. And it's funny listening to Barbara talk about this. I mean, you have 25 states that are joining, that are part of this thing. They're supposed to identify all the ineligible, but the eligible but unregistered voters. I don't think I heard a single discussion when that was being created about whether that should include, former felons. and maybe that's because there was mostly just white people in the room. I'm just observing that. But you know, you have a bunch of states that are swing states and politically swing states. They're politically purple. If you have statewide elections, they're very, very close. If you look at their state legislatures and their congressional delegations, they're some of the most extreme gerrymanders, which means that they're the most disproportionately representative. You have, 50-50 splits in presidential elections, governor's elections, and you have, two-third, one-third splits in these delegations because of the way lines are drawn. We've got a bunch of these states right now and it remains to be seen what these Democratic governors can do. North Carolina is another one. You have a Democratic governor and a Democratic appointee who's the new chair of the State Board of Elections, and they're siding with the voting machine companies to basically use, uncertified, unexamined machines in 2020 that will debut for the first time in the March presidential primary. I don't know. I'd like to know.
It's the curse of the corporate Democrats again.
I want to ask Barbara something that I heard that was really, really, stunning to me in terms of voter suppression and racial targeting, and it pertains to the primaries that are coming up, this winter. I heard that in some states like Michigan, where people don't register for a political party, they're called open primaries, that because basically the turnout is mostly going to be for Democrats, and it'll be much lower for Republicans because right now no one is running to challenge Trump, that the voters who turn out, especially in these communities of color and low-income communities, are going to be surveyed. They're going to be spied on and tracked so they can become later, their identities can then be, used later on as for targets for all kinds of online disinformation and shadowing and fear-based, messages or, distortions that either intimidate people from voting or would discourage them. So if you're an older woman and you own your house, maybe you'll get some messages saying your mortgage could be, reversed. If you're a younger person, you'll be told something else. If you're somebody who believes in pure ideas or ideologies, you'll be told voting is just a waste of time, nobody's good enough. But this notion that the primaries will be some of these open primary states like Michigan, like the Detroit area, Wayne County, that the Republicans will be looking to see who turns out to target them for disinformation. I found to be probably true, but fairly a stunning thing to hear. What do you think of that? What have you heard on those lines?
Yeah, I think that there's no doubt that, this whole voter intimidation, which is what we're seeing, as the result. I mean, that's why you got that 13 to 17 million eligible voters who were formerly incarcerated, who are eligible to vote in states like Illinois and others, who don't register and vote because they fear that they're going to be jailed. And that's why these states like North Carolina and Texas and others are going out of their way to arrest and to jail people who did not purposefully try to violate the law, who they know were unaware. And remember that in Illinois, so bad that they tried, the state legislature under the prior governor tried to pass a law to inform the 4 million people sitting up in Illinois who are eligible to vote but don't, because they don't know that. They were going to send some flyers and information and make sure that when people got out of jail, they knew. And the governor vetoed the legislation. Fortunately, the new governor has signed the legislation. But that just shows you that there's purpose in this. The whole purpose, the whole issue of voter discouragement is what won Trump the state of Wisconsin. We know that at least, 30 plus thousands of people and more were discouraged from voting in Wisconsin because of the Russian internet lies that were told to voters, because of the deceptive practices that were telling people they were going to be arrested if they voted even though they're legally, people who were legally entitled saying that they were going to be arrested if they didn't pay their utility bills, all this nonsense. They were discouraged because they were told they didn't have the right ID. And people said, well, why would I go if they're going to tell me I can't vote? Why would I stand in line for 2 and 3 hours if I can't vote when I get to the top of the line? So they used all of that to discourage voters. And they're going to do it again. Let's be very, very clear that, you know, we have to be tactically strong enough and smart enough to anticipate these kinds of tactics, the return of these tactics, and some new ones that will be designed to try to keep people from voting. And it's a tragedy in any democracy where the number that everybody.
Barbara, you're breaking up a little bit. I don't know if you moved away. We're almost to the end here, for God's sakes. Barbara Arnold, how do people get a hold of you? Yeah. How do people get a hold of you?
Oh, they can reach me. I am reachable at tjcoalition.org. I'm active on Twitter at Barbs73. Barbs73.
And what was your previous contact? It kind of broke up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know why. TJ.org.
Spell it out, please.
T as in Thomas, J as in Jefferson, Coalition, CoalitionOrg.
All right, very good. And Steve Rosenfeld?
Yeah, well, I'm with the Independent Media Institute. Stephen @ind.media is the email address. I respond to every email I get, and most of my stuff is published on a bunch of different progressive websites. And my focus these days is, it's been what kind of evidence are we going to have, if and when we have disputed vote counts. It's sort of starting line and finish line. And the stuff we've been talking about today is really starting line stuff. You know, just people are eligible, but they're being prevented from walking through that first door. And we're really heading into a season where the stakes, everyone says the stakes are as high as they've ever been, but they surely are. And some of the numbers that Barbara has thrown out here are just simply stunning. I mean, there are more. If former felons or people on parole, probation and parole, could vote, those would be bigger percentages than what these Republicans have been able to achieve with the most extreme gerrymanders. Just think about that. That's extraordinary.
Right, and it's devastating. And the kind of tracking that we've been seeing comes from this company, Cambridge Analytica, which goes into great detail and uses online tactics to both intimidate and misinform. Well, and of course, they're going to be out. And there is a lot of Russian money involved there. I mean, there's a whole dispute on the left about how much to talk about the Russians, but very quickly, I mean, we've talked about this before. Donald Trump is owned and operated by Putin. Putin is his mob boss. The Russian mob bailed Trump out in the 80s and 90s, and they own him. So this is not a case of collusion. It's a case of mob ownership. I just sat through The Irishman, not my favorite film, but, you get immersed in the mob culture. We have organized crime in the White House, and that's where this is coming from. And the only way they can hold power is to prevent people from voting. And that's in part these felons. There's a negative, obviously, connotation for felons, but most of it comes from the drug war, which was very specifically targeted to keep black people of color and young people from voting. And so we're looking at now at the fate of the earth here. I'm very, as an environmentalist, I'm very clear that the human species will not survive 4 more years of Donald Trump. I mean, primary among all the things he's done is to absolutely ravage whatever he can get his hands on in the natural environment. I think he's possibly sent down by space aliens to remove human beings from the face of the earth. Steve, one of the things you've been covering is the machine situation. We're like solar energy and nuclear power, we're on the brink of having voting machines that could actually guarantee a fair vote count with voter imaging. And yet there's tremendous ballot imaging, and there's tremendous resistance all over the country. Can you very, very briefly tell us what's going on with this?
Well, what's going on is this week, an appropriation bill that is headed to the president's desk for signatures basically has $425 million in it for states to buy new voting systems. So these are the voting machines that you would use if you use a computer, or the ones that scan the paper ballots and do the counting. And what's going on really is that, well, there's really two things. The manufacturers want to sell machines that replace human marks on paper with computer-generated printed ballots. And the reason they want to do that is they can, instead of having basically like a stall that's a plastic table that you buy for $100, you have to use a computer that you buy for $6,000. And also, what it does is it replaces the human role in marking a ballot. And also, after Election Day, where canvas boards get together and act as juries to decide if there are fights over what's called voter intent. Did somebody make a sloppy mark on the page? And this really comes to bear in the closest of elections and recounts. And what's happening there is, even though some of these machines are replacing human elements in ways that me and other people find very disturbing, because they remove the checks and balances in what's the lifeboat of our system, which is how you decide the most contested elections. There's other elements of the technology in some of these new systems that basically, if we were smart enough, could provide other forensic evidence trails where we could literally verify the vote, and we could quarantine problems down to the precinct level, and we could make the results or the evidence for results public, and nobody has to be told by an expert, no voter or citizen, to believe us. This is what happened. They could look and figure it out for themselves. And believe me, if there are close elections, candidates and campaigs will do that.
Listen, we got to come back to this. Steve Rosenfeld, Barbara Arnwine, you guys are tremendous.
Thank you.
We're going to have to keep
doing
it.
Thank you so much, Harvey.
We'll be back with both of you, and this is the life of the future of the planet rests on all of this. Thank you for being with us. Thank you, crew in New York. We'll see you next week in Solartopia.
Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
We bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, 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 don't you?